On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
I'm Madeline Brand. Let's press play.
I think in the past, a lot of the immigrants or people that came over there, from Mexico or from south of our borders, they came to cook and to maybe get into construction, and they were honest people just looking to improve the quality of their lives. Now you have people coming across these borders that want to kill us, and these borders have to be tightened up. And if you're here illegally, then you need to deal with it. It needs to be resolved.
OJ Rodriguez, a Latino Trump delegate from West Covina at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland last night. Polls show Rodriguez is in the minority of Latino voters, most of whom say they support Hillary Clinton. And after the convention this week, Donald Trump plans to take a so-called engagement tour to try to connect with more Latino voters. In the meantime, Latino Republicans have turned out in Cleveland. Press Play producer Anna Scott is there. She's been speaking with some. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline.
Hi. Well, what have you heard?
Well, a lot of different things. But one common theme that I've definitely heard from Republican Latinos here is that they're not single issue voters. They feel like they often get defined by the issue of immigration. And they wanted to make the point that they care about many more things than that. They care about the economy, about their own personal financial security, about national security. And so they don't think that that one issue defines either them as a voter or Trump as a candidate, even if some of his opinions give them pause, like the fact that he said he wants to build a wall at the Mexican border and make Mexico pay for it. So I spoke to one young delegate from Texas. Her name is Allie Corrales, and she's 18 years old. She's from Greenville, Texas, about this issue and about how she feels about it. Her father was brought to the United States when he was 8 years old, undocumented, went on to become a citizen, an engineer. She says they both now support Trump. And I asked her if she has conflicted feelings about that, given that her father was at one point an undocumented immigrant. So here she is.
Well, if he hadn't come, I wouldn't be here. So I do have some conflicted feelings, but I know that he's legal now. I do have conflicted feelings because a lot of my family even is still in Mexico, and a lot of them do not like Donald Trump. But what we're fighting for is a long-term solution that can enable more people to come to the United States legally, those who want to come and be American citizens.
So, Anna, is she typical in what you found when you talked to people on the floor last night?
Yeah, in terms of not wanting to be defined by that one issue, and also in terms of having some reservations and differing feelings about the wall and how Trump talks about immigration, yes, she was. Although I did also talk to some very enthusiastic Latinos for Trump who expressed very few reservations, actually like Mr. Rodriguez, who you heard at the very beginning of the segment. An interesting side note, he is in the real estate business and has been a Donald Trump fan for many years because of that. He said he read his books just for business advice many years ago. And I think there's a side story here to be done about real estate people in the California delegation. Just something I noticed. I know you're going to be talking about Jeff Palmer later on the show. So
okay. Yeah.
Total side note.
Jeff Palmer, the developer who's the single biggest individual donor to Donald Trump. We will be talking about that later on. Early this morning, though, you went to an event, I believe, put on by the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials. And this is a nonpartisan group, right?
Yeah, that's right. It was a nonpartisan group, but they were hosting a panel about Latinos and this election. And the panel was mostly conservatives, other than the director of the host organization. The panel included the former governor of Puerto Rico, Luis Fortunio, who's a Republican. It included Daniel Garza, who's executive director of the Libre Initiative, which is a group that goes out and connects with Latino voters, tries to organize. They do say they're nonpartisan, but have a reputation for being more on the right. And actually, when Daniel Garza said today that his group was nonpartisan, the audience laughed. So take that for what you will. And then Ruth Guerra, who is she's a spokeswoman for the American Action Network, which is a center-right sort of policy advocacy group. So the focus of the discussion was the fact that, like you said earlier, Republicans aren't really effectively tapping into the Latino electorate. And they talked about why that is and how they could be, and really really looked at just how big that voting block is. There were some interesting statistics that came out just even in the opening remarks that I just hadn't heard. They said that the Latino vote has grown 21% since 2012, which is quite a jump. Yet at the same time, they said they estimate there's something like 27 million eligible Latino voters for this election, but even though only about half of that will turn out to vote. So the focus was on how they could reach more of those people, how the Republican Party in particular could maybe connect more effectively.
Right.
And
were they saying similar things as the delegates did about Donald Trump?
Yeah, they were, even though, you know, they were actually a little harder on Trump. They also did make the point that Latinos are not single issue voters, once again, who only care about immigration, and also made the point that, hey, they're in every state, and politicians on both sides tend to just focus on the Latino vote in a few states. But on the other hand, several people said they were disturbed by how Donald Trump talks about the wall and immigrants. And so let's hear from one of them. I asked Daniel Garza, who's the executive director of the Libre Initiative and a conservative, if he thinks Trump is racist. And here's his response.
Well, on the one hand, you have a candidate who has taken a very harsh position on immigration. On the other hand, you have someone who's writing a check she cannot cash.
Do you think that Trump is racist?
I do not think he's racist. I think he has said some bigoted things. I think he was wrong and divisive about Judge Curiel, but I'm not going to go as far as to say he's racist. A racist implies that your race is superior to somebody else's. That's a strong accusation. Bigoted, it's, you know, we're an ethnicity. We're not a race to begin with. So bigoted means that, you know, you're just going to treat somebody different because they're not of your race. You know, you don't feel as comfortable with somebody else's race as you do with your own. So, you know, and that you have a wrong stereotype or a wrong understanding of somebody's culture. That I can see.
Okay, so some delicate parsing there. Did this issue of Trump's rhetoric and whether it's racist or bigoted, whatever, did that come up during the panel?
Yeah, there was actually a kind of dramatic moment during the Q&A portion of the panel, when Carlos Sada, who is the Mexican ambassador who was in the audience, raised his hand and asked the panelists to address that specifically. He said, Mexico is America's biggest trading partner. And then he said, yet we are the ones who keep being bashed every single day. And he said that Mexicans have been insulted in this election by Donald Trump. I should note that he was actually appointed to his position partly specifically to counter Donald Trump. So it wasn't that surprising that that's what he had to say. But Luis Fortunio, the former Puerto Rican governor who was on the panel, responded. He said that he was embarrassed by some of the positions that Trump's taken on the campaign path. And I asked him later to expand on that a little. And here's what he said.
He's addressing real issues, personal and economic. Security is a real issue today. Having said that, however, the tone, can change, and hopefully will. We'll see.
And what did he mean by real issues? He said personal and economic security, but what exactly does that mean?
Well, so he made the point that not just in the United States, but in the world right now, there seems to be a moment of closing off and looking inward. He talked about Brexit. He talked about the National Front in France. He said that the working class around the world right now feels left out of globalization, that there's resentment, there's fear, and that Trump is tapping right into that with his talk about the wall. And he doesn't think that's a healthy strategy. He doesn't think that's a good way to talk about that fear. But I think he was saying that, but that is a real fear that people have, and maybe we need to find a more constructive way to address it.
All right. So what are their ideas for how Republicans can connect more effectively, can capture a bigger share of the Latino vote?
In short, by improving their ground game. They talked about how Republicans really need to do a lot more outreach, in all the states, about how they should look at local races and down ballot races. It's not just about the White House. They said that they should capitalize on Hillary's unlikability. This is something that actually came up yesterday when we were talking about female voters. I talked to some female Trump supporters, and they expressed dislike for Hillary. She sort of has this murky quality that just turns some people off. And they talked about that today on the panel and said they should be capitalizing on it. And also, Republicans should focus on how their policies could help Latinos economically versus just talking about immigration. And also they said they should do more Spanish media. Republican candidates like Trump need to do more Spanish media and not be afraid of the language barrier.
All right. Anna Scott, producer for Press Play at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, polls continue to show an uphill climb for Trump when it comes to the Latino vote. A recent NBC News Wall Street Journal poll had 76% of registered Latino voters supporting Hillary Clinton. 82% of those polled had an unfavorable view of Donald Trump. The Pew Research Center shows a similar lopsided support for Clinton among Latinos. Mark Hugo Lopez, director of Hispanic Research at the Pew Research Center, is here now to talk about that. Hi.
Hi. How's it going?
Well, you listened to the last piece, and does what Anna heard at the Latinos at the convention, does that ring true when it comes to the statistics that you found in your survey?
Yes, particularly on issues. And one of the things about issues that we've seen over the course of the last decade or so is that immigration, while it's perhaps a more important issue for Latinos than it is for other groups of Americans in terms of how important it is for their vote, issues like the economy and health care and education have oftentimes been rated higher by Hispanic voters as important issues for determining their vote. That was true in our poll we just did earlier this year in June, but it was also the case in 2012 and 2008 and 2004, et cetera. So in looking at the issues, the economy and jobs particularly continues to be an issue that many Latinos point to. And it just points to the diversity of the community as well, that it isn't all a community of immigrants, nor even a community of immigrants and their children, that there's a variety of demographic groups within the Hispanic community, and they have different points of view.
And yet, overwhelmingly, it appears they support Hillary Clinton.
That's correct. And this really is continuing an ongoing trend where since the 1980s, Latinos have leaned heavily towards Democratic presidential candidates. And Democrats have won the Hispanic vote in each of these presidential election cycles with at the minimum of 58% in 2004 with John Kerry against George W. Bush. And George W. Bush, by the way, won about 40% of the Latino vote then. But it's been at least 58%, if not higher, in presidential election years.
So does Donald Trump do markedly worse than previous Republican presidential candidates?
This is actually a really good question because it's something that it's really hard to pin down what level of support is for Donald Trump among Latinos. We've seen polls like that NBC Wall Street Journal poll that you cited that had support for Trump at 14% among Hispanic registered voters. Our own poll that we did in late June of this year had his level of support at 24%. Others like Univision have had it at 19%. Fox News Latino at 23, you see that there's actually some variation here, and these do have margins of error. So while they may be different estimates, they are very close to each other, and Trump's level of support appears to be somewhere below Romney, but perhaps slightly at where Bob Dole was in 1996 with Hispanics when he won 21%.
But still nowhere near George W. Bush's 40%.
That's correct. Yeah, George W. Bush's 40% was a standout in over the last 30 years of presidential elections.
What is the generational divide here when you break down the polling numbers?
So one of the interesting things also is how different the Latino community is, and that registered Hispanic voters tend to be U.S. born. So, for example, about half of all Hispanic adults are foreign born or are immigrants. But when you take a look at among registered Hispanic voters, typically only 25% are immigrants. So immigrants make up a smaller share of registered voters. That means that people who are U.S. born with U.S. born parents make up a larger share of the registered voter pool of Hispanics, making up of about 30%+ of all Hispanic registered voters. That's important because many of them might have family ties in the United States of multiple generations, and they don't necessarily always have the same points of view as those who are more recent immigrants. In our survey that we did, we found, for example, that Spanish-dominant and bilingual Hispanics overwhelmingly supported Hillary Clinton with a rate of 80%. But when you take a look, for example, at English-dominant Hispanics, so those would be people who are U.S.-born, generally with U.S.-born parents, third generation or higher, you find that support for the two candidates is somewhat more split.
Why is that, do you think?
I think part of it is that when you talk about the Hispanic vote, much of the diversity in the Hispanic vote is coming from, in terms of its vote, is coming from those who are have family roots in the United States of multiple generations. Folks who, for example, may think that unauthorized immigrants in the country should be deported. Oftentimes, they are English-speaking Latinos who trace their family roots in the United States to three or more generations. It perhaps is somewhat also just a reflection of what happens as a community becomes a bigger part of the United States as part of the assimilation process that's happening as well.
Yeah, so then we see that Donald Trump is going to try to go on a connecting tour later after the convention to try to attract more Latinos into the party. And we've been hearing for a while that the Republican Party, as you have demonstrated with your polling, is having a tough time appealing to the Latino voters. But, you know, is that, as you say, if more and more Latinos are becoming assimilated and are splitting the vote when it comes to the, you know, the English-dominant Latino voters, then does that necessarily spell doom for the Republicans?
I certainly think in the short run, you will continue to see the Latino vote lean heavily towards Democratic presidential candidates, whether that's Hillary Clinton this year or whoever might be in 2020 or 2024. But certainly looking down the road, as immigration from Mexico has slowed substantially, so much so that we actually see more Mexicans returning to Mexico than arriving in the United States, that really means that as we move forward over the course of the next two, three, four decades, you're going to see the rise of U.S.-born Hispanics who may be English-speaking, may be proud of their Hispanic roots, but may look like other Americans in many other ways, from everything from their religious affiliation, for example, not being Catholic, to also the ways in which that they vote. So it remains to be seen what will happen, but I think that this assimilation, this change, is a long-run trend. It's something that we probably won't see to come to its full fruition until sometime in the middle part of the century, but it's already underway.
Mark Hugo Lopez, Director of Hispanic Research at the Pew Research Center. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Latino voters, we would like to hear from you. What is the single most important issue to you this election? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can tell us on Twitter at @KCRW PressPlay. Coming up, Latin alternative music. We'll find out who the hottest acts are. KCRW's Raul Campos is here. He's here next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Alternative Music Conference is the place to check out new bands and artists who come to New York once a year from all over the world. This year's conference just ended, and for the 10th year running, our very own KCRW DJ Raul Campos was the host. He's here now. Hi.
Hi.
The host of the whole thing.
The whole thing. Yes, a lot of running around. early mornings, late nights, and very little sleep.
So what happens at this conference?
Well, there's all kinds of stuff that goes on. The business side of it is discussions, panels for young burgeoning artists, how to get their music heard and how to, you know, get into the scene and into the business of it. But then there's also the showcases, which happen throughout the city and places like Central Park for Summer Stage, Brooklyn's Prospect Park for their Celebrate Brooklyn event, and places like SOB's, the Highline Ballroom, so many places around town.
And around the world, where's the most happening Latin music scenes?
Right here.
Right here in L.A.?
Of course, no.
Right here at KCRW.
Absolutely. No, you know, it's really from all over. I mean, you have legendary rock and español bands from Argentina and Mexico, but there's so many great sounds coming out of Spain and Colombia, Venezuela, and Chile. Like, even the scene down in Santiago, Chile is huge right now with people like Alex Anwanter, Ana Tijoux, who we're big fans of here at the station. Around the world, it's a big scene.
And the big prize is the Discovery Award.
Yeah, every year they give this award to who they think is going to be the next big superstar that's going to go on to do bigger and better things. And even dating back to the first LAMC, the band was Kinky. And we know they've become something huge. They're from Mexico. And over the years, there's been people like Carla Morrison, Los Racas. Last year was Buscabuya. And this year, it's Ile, and she's the young sister of the duo known as Calle 13. So it's a big deal because they're kind of like rap, hip-hop, reggaeton. And then we get this debut full-length from this songstress. And I say that because she is really singing beautifully boleros, mambo, cumbia, and ballads. And it's just a completely different thing that we all expected to hear on an album from her former alias was Peje 13. So you got Calle 13 and Peje 13, PG-13. But as Ile, she's got a solo debut album called Inevitable.
So tell us about the song that we're listening to. It's called You Say It, because you have a better Spanish accent than I do.
It's a mambo tune, and I'm all about dance music. So, I mean, I love the ballads. They're very pretty. But this is Te Quiero con Boogaloo, so a little bit of mambo flavor. And I recommend you check out the video when you're in your own private home.
Definitely
or
not PG-13.
Not PG-13.
Okay. Spelled I-L-E. Another young artist that got a lot of attention was a guy named Grenda.
Grenda is the son of one of the Nortec guys, Bostich.
Nortec Collective.
Yeah, Nortec Collective coming out of Tijuana. Now, the whole collective is a few people, but lately it's kind of shifted just to these two guys, Bostich and Fusible. And Grenda is the son of Bostich. So now 17 years old, and his first time in New York, playing at Central Park, new album. I mean, it's a big deal for this young gentleman. First time I heard the music, I was at South by Southwest in Austin, and I ran into Ramon Bostich on the streets, and he goes, hey, you gotta come check out my boy, he's performing now, he's gonna come out with music. So I'm all like, all right, cool. I got very excited. I'm all like, oh wow, is this like next generation Nortec Collective?
Yeah.
So we get into the room, and it sounds like I'm at an M83 concert, because it's all electronic, it's all darker, and he's singing. And in English. I'm all like, okay, this is a slight departure from what I expected to hear. Well, it's not Nortec Collective, but and it's not what I would expect to hear coming out of Tijuana. Close your eyes, think the wrong way to believe you say it back to me. Let me know
That's Grenda and his song, Let Me Know, 17 years old. And he's singing and playing all the instruments?
Everything. Yeah, and when you see him performing, it's him with, like, all kinds of keyboards and effects units. Of course, the microphone right in his face. But he also plays guitar, plays piano, and he sings.
All right, another artist. He's Mexican, an indie artist you like, is Leon Larregui.
Very
Did
good.
Did I say that okay?
Yes.
Okay.
Leon Larregui, he's of the band Zoe.
Spelled Zoe.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a solo album out. And why do you like him?
Well, I've been a big fan of Zoe for many, many years. They're going to be celebrating 20 years next year. In 2017 will be their 20-year anniversary. So they have a lot of albums. They sell out stadiums and festivals in Mexico. Even when they come to L.A., they sell out big venues. And Leon put out a couple of solo albums. The first one was very traditional, very straightforward rock. Guitar, bass, drums. And on this album, he definitely got a lot more experimental. And the cool thing also is this album is a little more personal. It's a little more introspective into the world of Leon, because when he started writing the album, they found out that his girlfriend was pregnant with his first boy. So a lot of the songs and the lyrics became much more personal, heartfelt, and spiritual, and very loving. That is Tiraste a Matar, which translates to shoot to kill.
Shoot to kill.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's cool stuff. I mean, Leon's been doing it for a while, and he's big in cinematography, and that's obviously, it's shown with the documentary Panoramas. He's shot a lot of the videos, not only for his solo album, but a lot of the Zoe videos. So he's a very talented individual.
Well, with KCRW as the exception, how hard is it for these artists to get airplay on radio stations?
It's very difficult. And to get these acts to cross over, it's one of the hardest things. I mean, even like a band like Café Tacuba, or, you know, all these other quote unquote legendary acts that have been doing it for 20, 30 years, it's still tough to get on the radio in the U.S. So to that whole idea of crossing over is still the main goal for all these bands. But it is very, very difficult.
So if people want to hear these artists, how can they hear more?
One of the big things on one of the panels was how to get your music heard. And there's so many outlets now. There's Spotify, there's Bandcamp pages, obviously their own streaming services that they offer, and through their own websites and social media outlets. YouTube is huge. It's not just one thing or the other. It's really a combination of everything to try to get heard.
Let's talk about one of the bigger bands. And they just played here in L.A. They were headliners in Central Park.
Mexorcy is kind of the brainchild of Camilo Lara, who is based in Mexico City. And he had this idea of creating this Mexican supergroup. And it includes Jay de la Cueva of Moderato and Phobia, Ceci Bastida, who played with Julieta Venegas in the group Tijuana No, also Chetes, who's a fantastic solo artist. So he created this supergroup to come together and reinterpret Morrissey classics in Spanish. So it's, you're taking these songs like Suede Head, Every Day's Like Sunday, International Playboy, and they're flipping them.
Crazy, you know my face. Oh,
like Morrissey and The Cure and The Smiths have always been a big thing in the Latino culture. Here in L.A., I'm born and raised in L.A., and that's how we would play it. Like, even back in the day, we would go from a classic rock and español song into a classic new wave song. And it's seamless because that's where the inspiration for these rock and español bands came from.
Supergroup Mexorcy, and Ceci Bastida is singing.
Mm-hmm.
What's that song called?
they're flipping it, and she's the international playgirl.
As opposed to the playboy.
Right, correct.
It's great.
And, you know, so like I said, there you can hear it, you know, where you can hear the original Morrissey tune, but, you know, they're definitely putting their own interpretation on it and their own twist.
Well, Raul, thank you for bringing in this music.
Well, thank you
great.
For having me.
Really fun.
Yeah.
That's Raul Campos, KCRW DJ. You can hear him on Saturdays and Sundays from 3 to 6 here on KCRW every weekend. And he's the host of the Latin Alternative Music Conference. For a list of all the best music from the Latin Alternative Music Conference, head over to our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the biggest single contributor to Donald Trump. It's a local developer, Jeff Palmer, the guy who builds all those faux Italianate apartment buildings downtown. And then later, why it's so hard to open a bar in Los Angeles.
There are restaurant owners who come in from other cities and think that they will open a branch in Los Angeles. And then they get here and they're like, good heavens, this is the most difficult thing I've ever gone through. It's really notorious here.
How to get your drink on, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Los Angeles real estate developer Jeff Palmer is not into small. Witness his faux Italian apartment fortresses in downtown LA. You know, the Medici, the Orsini, the Lorenzo. So perhaps it shouldn't be too surprising that Jeff Palmer has been named the single largest individual donor to Donald Trump's presidential campaign, apart from Trump himself. Palmer gave $2 million to a Trump super PAC called Rebuilding America Now. That's according to recently released numbers from the Trump campaign. Well, just as Donald Trump has courted controversy, so too has Palmer become a controversial figure here in Los Angeles. He successfully won two lawsuits against the city of LA that loosened affordable housing requirements for developers. Critics often cite these lawsuits as one of the reasons for the lack of low-income housing downtown. Let's talk about this all with Zachary Mitre, reporter at Bloomberg News, currently following Money in Politics. Hi there.
Glad to be here.
Also joining us, Eddie Kim, senior writer for LA Downtown News. Hi.
Thanks for having me, Madeline.
Great to have you back. Zachary, let's begin with you. Trump and Palmer seem to have a lot in common. Maybe it's their taste in Italian decoration. They're both real estate developers, though, and they are involved in some controversy when it comes to their developments. But beyond these similarities, what are the connections between the two?
Well, what we're seeing in the Trump campaign is that there's been a real shift in the kind of people who are giving money compared to people who supported past candidates. You know, there's kind of a typical group of major donors who support the Republican nominee every 4 years. And Trump hasn't won over all of those donors yet. And so in their place, he's kind of found some new people. And Jeff Palmer is one of them, who really didn't get all that deeply involved in Republican politics in the past, but who are giving, you know, who appear to be, you know, major supporters of Donald Trump.
So Jeff Palmer hasn't donated to previous Republican presidential candidates?
He's been a Republican donor in the past, but nothing nearly on this scale.
Of the $2 million.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Eddie, he is an elusive figure. He refused to comment to us. He says he doesn't give media interviews. But what do you suspect? You've covered him for a while. What do you suspect are the reasons he gave so much money to Donald Trump?
You know, Palmer is a very private person, but I did see him at a private Q&A last October at one of his developments where he talked about how, you know, things like how subsidizing housing is un-American, complained about so-called poverty advocates who criticize his career, and said a big motivator for him building housing is he doesn't like to pay taxes. And he said that tongue-in-cheek, but there's truth to it. So it's hard to know exactly what his politics are or why he supports Trump in terms of policy issues, but the attitude, I think, is someone who, you know, doesn't like to take no for an answer, does what he wants to do, and doesn't like, you know, being restricted by what he considers to be irrelevant rules, damaging rules to this Americanness of free real estate development.
Well, do you think he sees in Donald Trump a kindred spirit?
I'm not sure I would go so far as to say he sees a kindred spirit, but I think there are some clues that show they have a similar attitude when it comes to certain things.
And Zachary, another big real estate investor, the founder of Colony Capital here in Los Angeles, Tom Barrack, is a big Trump donor.
That's right. In fact, many of the major donors that have kind of come into the picture this cycle are people in the real estate business. I might also mention someone else in your neighborhood or Southern California anyway, Papa Doug Manchester, who is another kind of significant supporter of Trump's, who wasn't previously kind of in that top echelon of Republican donors. Barrack goes a little further. He's been friends with Trump for 35 years and is basically a close friend. We don't actually know. Mr. Palmer hasn't returned calls or emails this past week, so we don't know whether he also has a personal relationship with Trump or if this is just something he's kind of a fan from afar.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything to be gleaned in terms of Donald Trump's statements or his policy positions to indicate that he might favor some kind of beneficial tax rules or anything along those lines when it comes to real estate development?
It's hard to know. I mean, obviously, he's been a developer for a long time, so I'm sure if I were a fellow developer, I might, you know, have confidence that he understands the issues. But, you know, so many, and Eddie can provide more on this, but so many of these issues are really state and local matters rather than something that the federal government really gets involved in.
Right. And Eddie, speaking to that, if you could go into these lawsuits that Palmer waged successfully against the city of Los Angeles, what were the upshot of those?
Well, basically, he was facing, when he was trying to build in City West, the primarily now office neighborhood on the west side of the 110 freeway right across from downtown Central. Because there was new development pressure there, the city decided that subsidized housing should compose 15% of new housing projects in that neighborhood. And he hated that. You know, he fought against that tooth and nail, and he ultimately won the case in December 2007. The city, in kind of a risky move, appealed the ruling, and it was a risky, experts said, because while the original decision applied only to Palmer, an appellate court ruling could set a precedent in L.A. and also throughout the state. And that's what panned out. The state Supreme Court shot the appeal down in October, 2 years later, in 2009. And it's long been discussed, you know, would more inclusionary zoning, aka forcing subsidized housing on developers, would that hold up legally today as the city planning department figures out new community plans and new ways to, you know, keep neighborhoods inclusive? And because of this case and the shooting down of the appeal, it's a little tough. There's some gray area here.
Now, I understand that he once said requiring developers to include affordable housing units was, quote, immoral.
Yeah.
What did he mean by that?
Well, he's just saying, and again, this is from this Q&A where I got to grill him a little bit, but, you know, he thinks that forcing real estate developers to basically give discounts to people who can't afford housing is just not a very constitutional and very American way to go about it. I think he complained, I remember him saying, oh, you know, they don't make people in convenience stores subsidize their wares. Why should developers have to do it? We're, you know, target number one. There's a lot of counters to that point, but that's the kind of view that he takes. And just, you know, I'm sure he and Trump could sit down and have a really enthusiastic conversation about taxes and regulations that they hate.
Mm. Well, meanwhile, do people rent those apartments? Are they full up?
Absolutely. To my knowledge, most Palmer projects have always had strong occupancy. A lot of USC students, younger people, students going to the fashion school in downtown. And, you know, because they're on the outskirts, and the apartments aren't as luxurious as some of the new product coming online in downtown, pricing is pretty attractive, all things considered. They have lots of parking. They have a lot of amenities. The problem is for everyone who doesn't live in them. You know, a lot of these projects are like fortresses. They don't have good retail or any sort of cooperation with pedestrians in the street. You know, he was notorious for trying to build sky bridges to keep people off the sidewalk. You know, the implication being, hey, stay away from these dirty streets and potentially homeless people. And so, yeah. It's his projects are popular, but also controversial at the same time.
And Zachary, can we expect Donald Trump to return here a lot more often in the coming months to get more money?
Absolutely. California, Texas, and New York are the places you go to raise large amounts of money in a short period of time. And he's been particularly successful because so many of the top kind of people in his fundraising universe, Tom Barrack, Doug Manchester, Jeff Palmer, and also Steve Mnuchin, who's his national finance chairman, the former head of One West Bank, the former IndyMac, who's a Southern California guy. So you can expect Trump to be coming back again and again to fundraisers the rest of this year.
Well, thank you both very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Zachary Miter. He's a Bloomberg News reporter. He covers money and politics. And Eddie Kim, senior writer for the LA Downtown News. And coming up on this program, the best places to enjoy a summer drink outdoors and why we don't have beer gardens here in LA. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, sitting outdoors enjoying a cold drink is one of summer's great pleasures. And with several Los Angeles bars opening new patios this season, there's more opportunity than ever to do just that. Not only good news for customers, outdoor seating can be a boon for owners in a notoriously difficult industry. That is, if bar owners can jump through all the hoops to get their license and to actually make it. Catherine Spires is a food writer and co-host of the podcast How It Got In Your Mouth. She's here to break down the business of bar patios and, of course, where to find the best ones in LA. Hi, welcome back.
Thank you.
We have a shortage, do you think, of outdoor bar seating in Los Angeles?
We absolutely have a shortage, and it's so notable because we have weather that really lends itself to the sort of thing.
It's crying for it.
It's so crazy. You get a block off the beach, and there's no outdoor eating and drinking options. I mean, there are some, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do know what you mean. But why is that?
A lot of it has to do with how incredibly difficult it is to open a restaurant and or a bar in Los Angeles. There are restaurant owners who come in from other cities and think that they will open a branch in Los Angeles. And then they get here and they're like, good heavens, this is the most difficult thing I've ever gone through. It's really notorious here in LA.
And is it just all the regulations that you have to go through?
You have to get approval from so many different departments and bureaus and other government agencies. And it's really confusing. For instance, if you're looking at kitchen equipment, things like grease traps, both the Bureau of Sanitation and the Department of Building and Safety have to approve all of your kitchen items. And those two departments don't have anything to do with each other. They don't communicate with each other. One of them might say yes, and then a week later, the other one's going to say no, and you're back to square one. And then maybe you'll get approval from the other one. You'll change whatever you need to change. And then the other department has to come back and approve it again.
Well, it makes you wonder how we have such a lively restaurant scene if it's so difficult.
It does make you wonder. We actually have restaurants were doing okay. But when it comes to places with full liquor licenses, whether they serve food or not, we don't have that many. It's so confusing. Like the fact that bars have to have parking lots, that actually makes no sense. That's a terrible thing. You shouldn't encourage people to be driving themselves to a bar, but you still have to have parking lots. So, you know, there's all these things that just regulation upon regulation has made things very counterintuitive.
Is it harder to open a bar by itself than a bar restaurant?
It is, because if you are a bar that also serves food, and the term for that is a bona fide eating place, that's the official term, you have to genuinely be selling food, then it's a little bit easier than opening a place that only serves alcohol. Part of that is because of you need to get your license from the ABC. That is actually a bigger agency, but and before you can get that, you need to get a conditional approval from locally to serve alcohol. And that involves appealing to your neighborhood council or the neighborhood council of the neighborhood you want to open in. And as someone who finds local politics and civics interesting, I will say anecdotally, of course, but there is a correlation between teetotalers and the type of person who wants to be on a neighborhood council.
You mean a direct correlation?
Yeah. Again, I haven't done a scientific study, but this has been my observation.
Because they're not in the bars, they're at the neighborhood council meetings instead.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, they get knocked down left and right. Silver Lake, which is where I live, Dana Hollister has been trying to open a bar hotel and a hotel for years. She keeps getting knocked back. It's not easy, both for social reasons and governmental reasons.
And that's because they represent the interests of homeowners who don't want loud bar patrons?
Ostensibly, they might be representing only their own interests as individual homeowners. But yes, ostensibly, that's why.
But is that generally the reason why it's hard to get a license to sell alcohol?
Yeah, the conditional use permit, they'll say things like, well, there's a school, you know, mm-hmm. however many miles away, and ABC is less inclined to help you out if the conditional use permit hasn't been approved. So there's a lot of back and forth.
Well, you'd think, though, then the lucky few who are able to go through this bureaucratic morass would be primed to make a lot of money because there aren't that many of them.
Yeah, but you have to spend so much money. So it's kind of like you have to weigh your options. I'm going to spend all this money at the outset. The unicorn is when you are able to get a spot that already has the full liquor license, which this place that I love, Everson Royce Bar, it's owned by the same people who own Silver Lake Wine, and they were offered the space that already had a full liquor license in place, and they knew that they would be fools to turn it down, even though they had only meant to open a wine store downtown.
This yeah. is also in the Arts District?
Mm-hmm. It is.
Yeah. And they have an outdoor patio.
They have one of my favorite new outdoor patios. It's glorious. It has a bocce court. It has these charming hung lights everywhere and a big fence and huge tables. It's great for a party. I like it a lot.
What are some other great patio spots?
There are some new ones this year that have opened up. One of them is Sawyer, which is right in Sunset Junction. And it was clearly designed for Instagram, but I have no problem with that. Everyone's got to market however they do. It has these gorgeous high ceilings, and you actually walk through the restaurant and get to the back, which is where their open-air patio is, and it has a fire pit in the middle that they won't need for a few months, but it's all very charming. Like it a lot, and they have a great happy hour. And then a little further east, in Frogtown, there's a new spot called Salazar This might be my very favorite. It has a really interesting cocktail program and really good food and just a massive outdoor space. It used to be an auto mechanic garage, so everywhere that you could park a car is now tables and chairs and charming little seating areas.
And the neighborhood council apparently said okay.
Yeah, that one they allowed. I think because there isn't that much going on in that particular area of town. So maybe there are
a lot of warehouses.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
All right. Once you get a seat outdoors and you're ready to sidle up to a nice cold drink, what do you recommend? What's a good summer drink?
One that is great for summer and I'm also seeing on more and more menus around town is the Paloma. And I couldn't be more pleased.
The Paloma.
Yeah. It is a Mexican drink, and it traditionally is made with Squirt. The alcohol in it
is soda.
Tequila.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Squirt the soda. You mix it with tequila. As upscale restaurants start embracing the Paloma, they're doing stuff more along the lines of like a freshly squeezed grapefruit juice.
Stick with a Squirt.
You just need grapefruit flavor and tequila, and you've got a Paloma. And they're all over town, and they're perfect for summer.
Catherine Spires, food writer and co-host of the podcast How It Got in Your Mouth. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thirsty, Julie Myers?
Always?
You want a Paloma?
No. I hate tequila. I can't do it. Good tequila is good tequila and everything, but I am just always going to be a beer gal.
You are a beer gal.
And with that in mind, a couple of beer outdoor drinking establishments. Verdugo Bar in Glacel Park has kind of like a baby beer garden vibe. We don't have any real like solid German style beer gardens here in LA, but if you're looking for that, Verdugo Bar is going to get you close. Also, Brewery West in San Pedro has a really great space. Outdoor drinking, lots of people mingling together, great community space. Blue Cow downtown, also really good. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of outdoor drinking downtown unless it's on rooftops, but they have a great kind of courtyard vibe to it as well. We also talked about, not beer, though they may want a beer after this week, Latino voters and what they want, what the issues are that matter to them. Mario Jacques tweeted us that education, the Supreme Court, jobs, and immigration are his top issues. And George called in. He's a first-generation Mexican-American. He is most concerned about raising wages for the middle class, but he's also very concerned on how to get millions of undocumented immigrants out of the shadows. There's lots of talk. Not so much action over the last decade or so. So that's what he's looking for when it comes to candidates in the election.
Okay. Thank you very much, Julie Myers. If you'd like to tweet us your thoughts, please do at KCRW Press Play. I am at The Mad Brand. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.